This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today, I'm talking to Brando Skyhorse. He is the author of a novel called The Madonnas of Echo Park. And hey, Brando, how are you?
I'm very well, David. Very happy to be talking with you today.
I'm really glad to be talking to you. Now, just to make sure I get it right, this book is now out in paperback. Correct. This was out in hardcover.
Just out in paperback with a brand new cover, reader guide in the back, author Q&A, very reasonable price point. So, you know, go out there, get your copies. They did a phenomenal job on the jacket. They did a rejacket for the paperback, and I just think the new edition looks lovely. So,
the color, the purple is really beautiful.
Yeah, they really did. They knocked it out of the park. So,
right.
Yes.
Well, and you know, your background is, and you know, maybe or may not be known to people who are listening, but your background, you did get an MFA in writing.
I got an MFA from UC Irvine right after college. I went to Stanford and graduated in 1995, and I was 22 in the MFA program, and I was the youngest person there, and I only bring that up because I was way too young for that program. I should have gone out and actually lived some life and had some experiences as opposed to going into an MFA program, you know, right after college, but it seemed like the right thing to do at the time.
Well, you know, that actually is a criticism, I think, that has been lodged against some of the MFA programs. I don't want to get off on that tangent, but it is true, I think, that, you know, some people have said, you know, writers should live life and have experiences before they try to write. But obviously, you don't have to necessarily have the experiences before you learn to write. In your case, you got the MFA, and then since then you went to work in New York Publishing as an editor.
That's right. That's right. Yes. Yeah, and not to get on that MFA tangent at all, but I do find it an interesting topic to discuss about. I think for me, the most important thing that the MFA did was it gave me 2 years with which to write really bad stuff. And that's what every writer needs to do. Every writer needs to go through a period where they just write trash, garbage, basically, and do it in an environment where you can kind of put all this stuff out there and you're put on a schedule. You know, as far as, like, the criticisms of, you know, it produces a certain kind of writer, that's a separate discussion. But, you know, for me, it was just more important to have some sort of framework with which I could, you know, read good writing and be exposed to different writers and just learning how to, like, you know, critically assess other people's work, which I think, you know, segued quite nicely into becoming, you know, an editor in publishing.
Well, maybe you could talk a little bit about that. I think the experience you had of being an editor, you obviously could be beneficial to you in terms of your writing and your understanding of how writers work. you know, in another way, that could be a pretty powerful driver for your own experience. And I guess, you know, maybe you want to talk about that a little bit and how that works.
Absolutely. No, I think that with regards to editing, it was incredibly useful to learn how to articulate what it is you felt was working or not working with a particular piece. When I came to New York, I had this, you know, big, bulky 750-page novel that, you know, I thought, like, I'm going to publish it and I'm going to be rich and famous. And, of course, that didn't happen. So I ended up getting a job as a publisher's assistant at a small house that specialized in outdoors books and fly fishing. And as one of the offshoots of the job, you know, I just started reading the slush pile, and I found it was very, you know, it was an education, basically, to see all these people, aspiring writers, trying to, like, you know, kind of break through that wall, the same wall that I was trying to break through. And, you know, once I took a greater interest in the slush pile, then, you know, I was sort of tracked in an editorial capacity. And, you know, the MFA is a two-year program, and while it was incredibly, you know, it was a wonderful experience to work with writers like Jeffrey Wolfe and Judith Grossman, the people who were running the program in Irvine at the time, it was in many ways a much more beneficial education to work in an editorial capacity and to see, you know, to be actually having conversations with working writers, because I did almost exclusively nonfiction. So these are writers who are professional journalists, you know, they write on deadline, they're working on books that, you know, sometimes have taken them, you know, 5, 6, 10 years even, and to be able to, you know, ask these writers why did you intend to do this way, or where is the supporting evidence for this? Because I think in nonfiction, it's much easier to do that. It's almost kind of like building a case, as it were. You know, you say, like, here's what you need to prove in this chapter, and here's what the writing should be doing, and it's not doing. And it was then, I think it was more like, you know, after a few years, I started to realize, because I'd never stopped writing. When I got to New York and, you know, I wasn't able to get published, I kept writing in sort of an, you know, just kind of like in a hobby kind of capacity. And I noticed over a period of time that my writing was getting better, it was getting sharper, and it felt like I was using the same diagnostic tools that I was using as an editor in my own writing. I think the lessons were much more subconscious. I think the lessons were more like, okay, I'm going to ask myself these questions before I even start putting words down on the page. And so I think over a period of time, you just sort of like absorb these ideas about what good writing should be, and you know, you incorporate it into your own work. I think one of the things that I learned that was probably most important to my development as a writer is that you need to keep developing. And I think, I know that sounds like really obvious, but it's like, it does you no good if you write 1,000 words a day, each one of those words is bad. You know, if you keep writing 1,000 words, like 1,000 bad words a day, you're not growing, you're not evolving, you're not learning anything. And I think that a lot of people conflate or confuse the idea of being diligent with being proficient. And I think that working as an editor kind of helped me, you know, make the distinction between not only just getting the work out of my system, but also making the work better and sharper. I think there's an old Kurt Vonnegut quote that said, see if I can remember this correctly, but he said, there's always been creative writing teachers. They were and they continue to be called editors. And I think that that's probably like the best sort of description I've ever heard of what an editor actually does.
Yeah, no, I think that's really accurate. I mean, what's interesting, and now we can talk a little bit about the book itself too, is that while you've just described a learning process for yourself based on nonfiction writing, which is kind of, let's say, descriptive,
sure,
and analytical, Madonna's of Echo Park is quite different. Your style is it's indirect much more. It's evocative and kind of pictures in words in some ways, but it's also portraying a fairly complex ethos of a community, of a bunch of people in that community through interlocking stories, which is, you know, almost nonlinear. In fact, it is nonlinear. And so it's really different from what you've just described as the basis of your learning in a way. And I think that's really interesting because it shows that you maybe absorbed that skill set, as you said, subconsciously, but in the service of something very different.
I think that's absolutely true, and I think that's an excellent point. I've had a lot of these types of discussions and conversations, and I don't think anyone's ever actually raised that point before, because I think the idea is that, you know, the experience is supposed to be write what you know. You know, and I think it would have been probably would have had a much easier time writing the book if I had written something that was more along the lines of the kind of stuff that I was editing, something that had a very sort of, not necessarily direct, but almost had kind of like a straightforward documentarian kind of feel.
Right.
And I think that the fact that I decided to do something a little different means either I'm a masochist, which I, you know, is a reasonable argument, or that it's a reflection of the kinds of work that I always read for pleasure, that I always enjoyed. I think part of the reason that I never edited fiction, it was basically a conscious choice. I mean, not only, you know, because everyone in publishing wants to edit fiction, is that I never felt that I could keep the strands separate. I knew that I had desires to be a fiction writer, and I never felt that I could, you know, make myself, I could separate my ideas of what I thought good fiction was from the fiction that I was editing at any particular time. I think it was much easier for me to keep a more objective viewpoint working on nonfiction, because then it was like, well, I don't really have an interest in being a nonfiction writer, so there was never any idea of like, oh, you know, my jealousy is going to get in the way of editing this particular title about, you know, Baghdad or whatever particular book I was working on. Though, ironically, the next book I'm working on right now is nonfiction, so I don't know what that says about me. But
I think that's a good point. And the point there is also that, you know, if you had been editing fiction, it might have subconsciously influenced you as a fiction writer in a way that you might not have wanted it to.
I think that's a good point. I think that's absolutely a good point. And I think for me, you know, one of the things I always try to keep at the top of my list when editing a book is to try to help the writer communicate what it is that they wanted to say, not what I wanted them to say. And I think that that's a mistake that a lot of people who look at other people's writing, you know, if you've ever written something and you give something to a reader, you know, the bad readers say, you should have done this. The good readers always say, oh, what were you trying to do here? Oh, in that case, you should do this.
Right.
And I think that's a really important distinction. And, you know, not to double back on the MFA conversation that we've had, I think that a lot of people who go into MFA programs make that mistake as well, students who are in the workshop. Because, you know, you're in a workshop where you have a lot of talented writers with you, and they all have their own sort of ideas about what good writing, good fiction should be. They tend to steer your work towards what they think the work should be if they were writing it, as opposed to trying to get you to get the best work out of what you intended to do as a writer.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Let's talk some more about the Madonnas of Echo Park. And just for, you know, for people who may not have read it, the setting is Echo Park is a community, a part of a neighborhood in Los Angeles. It's where you grew up.
Mm-hmm.
The book takes place in the between the 80s and the present. And Echo Park, you know, before you were there even, was a very very Mexican neighborhood that was almost separate from the rest of Los Angeles, kind of
That's right.
forgotten
That's right.
part of it. It was, you know, over the hill from downtown L.A., you know, kind of not, you know, and I think this probably happened in a lot of cities, you know, in the period that they were growing in the 20th century. There would be areas that were not interesting to the developers, not interesting to the, you know, to the commercial people, you know, the people who are trying to live, you know, build big buildings, and areas that became homes for, shall we say, maybe the poorer communities, not necessarily impoverished, but just neighborhoods of different standing.
Sure. No, it's one of those things where, like, you know, L.A. history is fascinating to me, and it's fascinating for a number of reasons, primary of which is that, like, you know, even so few of Los Angeles' residences, current residences, know anything about Los Angeles history, because I think, unlike in New York, you know, where it's like you have this sort of finite amount of space, the idea of Los Angeles is sort of like this, you know, nebulous and amorphous geography where it's like, well, you know, you don't need to build in the same space because there's always more space elsewhere. So you can just kind of remodel and rebuild neighborhoods in whatever fashion or manner that you see fit. Echo Park is adjacent to the Dodger Stadium area, which, as I mentioned in the book, back in the 50s was, you know, called Chavez Ravine. And Chavez Ravine was where a lot of Mexicans, you know, bought and owned houses and owned property because they weren't allowed to buy houses in any other part of the city. And what happened was that when the city was trying to get, you know, the Dodgers from Brooklyn to come out to Los Angeles, they promised them a new stadium. And where better, you know, what better place to build a stadium than in an area where the people could basically just be swept aside? And, you know, it's one of those little, like, you know, nuggets of history. Like, I think I saw a documentary on YouTube a while ago where they were asking people in the parking lot, oh, hey, did you know what used to be here before Dodger Stadium? And, like, you know, they couldn't find one person. That's really sad. But and I think that Echo Park being adjacent to that area, you know, my grandmother, you know, bought a house in 1952, which is, I believe, was right around the time that Chavez Ravine was being cleared out. So this was a part of history that, you know, I was familiar with. And it's one of those things where, like, you know, when she first came to the neighborhood back in the early 50s, it was predominantly white. And, you know, my grandmother told me about what the neighborhood was like at that time. You know, she was asked by her neighbors to sign a petition to change the mailman on their route because he was black. That was the kind of neighborhood they grew up in, or that was the kind of neighborhood that Echo Park was, or at least on her street. And, of course, that changed over time because as far as my understanding of what Echo Park used to be back in the 40s and 50s, it was where a lot of, like, Polish and Italians had settled post-World War II. And then after the neighborhood started, you know, to attract Latinos, those groups moved out of the area, and then it became predominantly Latino until the 70s. And then you had an influx of Vietnamese and Cambodian immigrants because of the Vietnam War. And so then the neighborhood changed again. So the time period that I'm writing about is really just, it's a period of Echo Park's, you know, a long period of transition, long series of transformations, but it's the period of transformation that I was most intimately familiar with because that's that's the time period in which I grew up in the neighborhood. But yeah, Echo Park, it just it has an incredibly rich, incredibly fascinating history. You know, Max Sennett used to have a studio in Echo Park where they filmed the earliest Keystone comedies, you know, like Up in the Hills. Like, this is back, you know, right around the turn of the 20th century. So it's a neighborhood that has just seen a lot of changes and a lot of transformations. And we were talking about this earlier about, you know, the current gentrification that the neighborhood is undergoing now, which is, again, it's like equally fascinating to me. You know,
well,
a lot of people have a lot of, yeah.
Right. And you mentioned that in your book. I think as you portray the main characters in this book, they're young at early, you know, at different points. It's actually hard to say different parts of the book, but they're younger, and then you bring them back at an older age. Most of them return later as you have them kind of returning to their, well, I guess it's Aurora returning to the neighborhood.
Right.
And it is, I did find it fairly complex to try to keep track of everybody. As I was reading the book, I didn't read about the book before I started reading it, so I wasn't thinking about the structure of the book. I was just reading it flat without any introduction. And first you have this author's note at the beginning. I wanted to ask you about that because in the back of the book, in the book club reading section, which I usually don't like to read, I think they really often are kind of distracting questions, but they mentioned that is a fictional author's note, which
did not
even enter my mind when I read it. But as I read through the book, I was reading, you know, I kind of didn't get it for a while, you know, how people were interconnected.
Right.
And that the core image of the story, and I don't think it's giving anything away to bring this up, that the Madonnas of Echo Park relate to this key scene in the book where there's a drive-by shooting by a gang member, a gangbanger, who accidentally kills a 3-year-old girl who is part of this group of girls dressing up as Madonna at the point when she was, you know, kind of lionized as a, you know, because of doing the MTV video where she dresses as a Mexican.
Right.
And all of your characters are connected to that event, which is what it took me a while to realize that, which is great, I think, because it's, you know, it enriched the experience for me. I hope I haven't given this away and screwed it up for anybody who reads it after hearing this. But I thought that was a really wonderful, let's say, leverage point for the story to revolve around, because it is, you come at it in a prismatic way. You know, you're seeing it from different points of view. Characters
right.
you didn't even realize were going to have a connection to it, it's very important to them. I won't talk about it anymore because I do think I would give away things that are important for people to discover. But all of the characters are connected. That they live through each other, and the kind of maybe not leverage point, but the fulcrum is the drive-by shooting.
Well, yeah, and I think that's, you know, again, it's just sort of like, for me, that was sort of like the entry, well, you know, two entry points, basically, you know, to mention briefly what you were talking about earlier, you know, the conceit of the fictional author's note. If you bought the book in hardcover, there's nothing in the back that acknowledges that the author's note is fictional, except if you look on the copyright page, it says, this is a work of fiction. But I was fascinated with the idea of having something like that because, you know, I'm working on a memoir right now, and for a number of years, I believed, unknowingly, you know, because this is what I was told by my mother, that I was a Native American. And you would think with a Brando Skywars, that's a pretty good clue that this person is Native American. And then when I found out that I was Mexican American, you know, I was encouraged to keep that deception up. My mother was living her own life as a Native American as well, even though she was Mexican American. So I wanted to create some sort of like story that would be representative of the kind of experience that I had, which was basically, you know, sort of denying this heritage that I had. And I wanted to use the idea of an, because, you know, if you look in fiction, you know, the idea of like fictional author's note, it's like, you know, it's been done, but, you know, Life of Pi has a fictional author's note. But when I was working on the book, the whole business about memoirists faking things, I'm not going to mention any names, of course, but I think we all know who we're talking about. As part of the penance that this particular memoirist had to engage in for, you know, fabricating certain things in the memoir, was that he had to write an author's note.
Right.
And I thought, wow, that's brilliant, right? Because it's like, if you didn't believe what was in the book, why would you believe what's in the author's note? And
right.
I'm like, oh, it's the word author's note. It's that, like, one sort of thing. It's that, like, pillar that, like, kind of says, whatever you're about to read is absolutely 100% true. So I thought, what better way to, like, kind of describe sort of my experiences of living my life as a Native American and denying this heritage than in a fictional author's note? And what better way to sign it than with my initials, BS, right? Which is probably reading way too much into it.
No, that's great, though. I think it illuminates it in a lot of ways, that because what, you know, what you're talking about is identity and truth. And,
right.
You know, fiction...
Right.
Is truth, but told through not necessarily a literal truth.
Right.
And so I think then your, you know, the fictional author's note, whether you know it or not as fiction, I think it contributes to this story.
Well, there's that, and then, you know, to take your second point just briefly in terms of, like, the idea of, you know, the Madonna video and the idea of this sort of conceit that, you know, when I was growing up in the neighborhood, there were people, I was introduced to Madonna by someone in elementary school who believed that Madonna was a Mexican.
Right.
And so that was my understanding of it as well. So the idea of, like, sort of identity, what does it mean to be American, what does it mean to be Mexican, you know, the fact that, like, Madonna was important to this girl for not only the fact that she was a pop star, but because she was a Mexican pop star. So sort of this idea that, like, oh, all of a sudden you could be Mexican in this country and famous too, which I know sounds really absurd, but if you think about, like, the mid-'80s, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, that seemed like a very revolutionary idea. And maybe it's indicative of where we've come, you know, sort of like where the hands on the clock have come in our country, whereas the idea of, like, somebody who's famous and Mexican is not quite as big a deal, you know, as it used to be. But, you know, back then it seemed like something that was, like, entirely groundbreaking. So I wanted to create something. I wanted to create a fictional universe or a story out of the seeds of that idea. And, you know, the fact that the event centers around people emulating, dressing like Madonna, because for me that was, like, sort of the big experience in the 80s, like the whole Madonna wannabes. It was a big thing. It's like, you know, that was how I was introduced to this idea of how you could be American, how you could connect with others, you know, even if you lived in a poor side of town, the poor part of town, or even if you didn't have access to the same things that, you know, other kids in the suburbs did, if you could access the same pop cultural sort of, like, tropes,
right.
If you could, like, be all on the same playing field, it meant that you could be somehow more American. And, you know, to me, like, that was a really big deal. I mean, I remember, like, in elementary school, Vietnamese kids, you know, coming to school with, like, Ghostbusters t-shirts and being very proud of that fact. It was kind of like, you know, hey, like, my family's, like, you know, not only, like, they can afford t-shirts with brands on them, but it's like, I know what Ghostbusters are, you know? And it was like this kind of thing where, like, somehow the playing field had been leveled by, you know, having access to these sort of, like, things like movies and videos, which may seem really silly, but, you know, if you're a kid growing up in a, you know, neighborhood that is, you know, predominantly lower class, you know, to be able to say, like, I know what that touchstone is, you know, you get a sense of pride from it. You get a good feeling from it.
Well, and it's,
so,
I guess it shows you the power of television and pop culture.
Absolutely, absolutely.
You know, which takes over, you know, identity. You know, it's sort of the irony there of Madonna appropriating a Mexican identity, then popularizing it as a positive role model for Mexicans whom she
right,
is not.
Right, right.
Which is, you know, there's a paradox there that's very powerful, I think, and people subtly absorb that information. It's sort of, the other character in here I thought was really interesting was to have Morrissey, which, you know, I thought was very interesting. And then you have the quote at the beginning that I rediscovered, I wish I was born Mexican, but it's too late for that now.
I just think that, you know, it makes me laugh because I think it's one of the most hilarious, like, Morrissey. Like, Morrissey is eminently quotable. Like, I love the guy. I've loved his stuff for years. And, again, you know, I was introduced to Morrissey by a friend in high school who was Mexican. And I discovered that there's this whole subculture. I mean, you just have to do a little research online. You know, it seems like every 3 years, Spin Magazine does an article about, why do Mexicans like Morrissey so much? It's like, I don't know, but it's true, especially in Southern California. What's the deal? I don't know. But, it's, again, this sort of weird thing where, like, Morrissey doesn't have that sort of like national prominence, you know, I mean, not here in America, but in England during the 80s, the Smiths were huge, but, you know, he never achieved that same level of stature here. But, you know, why would, you know, a guy from Manchester singing about what you would think were, you know, uniquely British ideas of, you know, sort of sexuality and depression and this and that, like, you know, because if you look at a lot of his songs, some of them are very, very British. Why would he be embraced by Mexican Americans in Los Angeles? I don't really know, but I think it's kind of a fascinating thing to talk about and to write about, and so I wanted to do both. So.
Well, maybe that's another book you can write about, and that is, you know, the popularity of popularity of pop culture figures in communities to which they don't belong. That would be a really interesting story. Now, does Jack Kerouac is yours alone, though, I would think, not necessarily shared by others. You know, he's another one that you quoted. You know, he's obviously maybe a different connection. But
yeah, he's definitely a different connection. And, of course, the Richard Pryor quote at the front as well. You know, and to me, I think of all the quotes on the front, you know, Pryor's quote, you know, I'm a huge Richard Pryor fan. I was introduced to him by my mother, who loved him as well. And, you know, his, like, you know, sort of sardonic take, it's no fun to pick on Mexicans. You guys got a country. And, like, the meaning of that, you know, and what is that kind of statement? Because, you know, he said that in, like, 78, one of his stand-up shows. But, like, the idea of, like, you know, you guys got a country. What does that mean now? Because, you know, if you were to, like, you know, look online or to go to certain blogs or certain commentators, you know, their idea of what it means for a Mexican to have a country has a very different take than it would have had, like, 30 years ago. And I guess I felt like those three quotes, the Kerouac, the Morrissey, the Pryor quote together, cumulatively gives you an idea of what the book is going to be about. And what my goal for the book is. So I feel like all those quotes are really excellent entry points into the universe.
The last one I wanted to ask you about of that front matter is this, which looks like a part of a poem, or maybe it's the whole poem by a guy named Jeff Lytle.
Yes, it's a poem. Oh, please go ahead. Please go ahead.
No, it's a beautiful, beautiful piece.
He will love to hear that. That's actually, I'm going to take this link when you post this online. I'm going to send it to him and ask him to replay this loop, because he has sort of a complicated relationship with his work, to say the least. I think he's an extraordinary poet. I met him when I was at UC Irvine, and he was in the MFA poetry program. Most people don't know that, you know, at Irvine, which has this incredibly, you know, hugely famous MFA fiction program, you can get an MFA in fiction and in poetry. So we were both starting there at the same time. And we've been friends ever since. And, you know, he has seen sort of my trials and tribulations, you know, attempts to get published, various sorts of, like, I'm never writing another word again types of stories. So to me, it seemed perfect for him to give him kind of like a space to, like, just to give him an opportunity to write something that was, you know, sort of his interpretation, not only of my work and not only of the book, but I think his interpretation of, like, my journey to become a published writer. Because I think it's always inspirational, no matter who it is, you know, no matter who you know in your MFA program or your circle of friends, when you see someone working for years at something and then they finally get a taste of it, they finally kind of crack through, you know, it's always an important moment. Because, you know, him and I have been reading each other's work for years. And, you know, I think it was incredibly gracious and incredibly touching of him to contribute something that I was actually able to put in the book. So, yeah, I'm glad you like it. I think it's wonderful.
Did he write this piece after reading your novel, or did you find this in his work and just because it's so appropriate to you know, L.A., a kind of...
It's perfect, right? Yeah, it totally is. No, he actually wrote it after reading the book, and I remember having this conversation because he was having, I think, you know, some doubt about, like, you know, his approach towards poetry and why he was doing it. You know, just as every writer does. And we were actually having this conversation outside the Strand bookstore, which is, again, like one of the greatest bookstores in America. You know, you've never been to New York and you only have one day to go. The Strand is where you should spend all your time because they have, like, just miles and miles of books. So we were standing out there and I said, look, you know, I think people would love your work if you give them a chance to discover it. So if you write something, I'll put that right in the front of the book. And, you know, thankfully he did. I think it also helped that he's, you know, having lived in Southern California, he lives in San Diego now, but he spent, you know, a number of years living in Irvine, going up to L.A., so I think he understands the city. I mean, I think he gets the idea, not only from my sort of, you know, artistic impression of what Los Angeles is, but from his own experiences as well.
Well, you know, the literature of Los Angeles, I mean, it's interesting, too. You know, there's a huge poetry scene in L.A., which for years has really been neglected
and
misunderstood. And you know, the poetry, I think there's a lot of sense even in the literary world that Southern California writing is in some way less depthful. That's a bad word, but, you know, aside from, you know, the kind of imagery we have of Southern California from the movies and writers who've written books that have been adapted to movies or, you know, who wrote about Hollywood, there isn't really a wide or maybe a broad understanding of the depth of Southern California literature.
I think that's absolutely right. Or, you know, if you do say Southern California literature, you know, you get like a very short list of names like Bukowski or people like that.
Right.
I think that for a number of years, L.A. has this idea that New York harbors some sort of resentment or it's not interested in L.A. literature. And I know that as an L.A. writer, because I do, even though I live out here in the East Coast, I do consider myself a Los Angeles writer, for better or for worse. I do think that there's this idea that, you know, New York publishing kind of looks down at, like, whatever literature is created in L.A. because it's either always about Hollywood or it's always about the movies or it only follows, like, you know, very particular tropes. And that's a real shame because, you know, some of my favorite books, you know, are set in Los Angeles or written by Los Angeles writers. You know, when I was at the UCI workshop, I was in the workshop with Amy Bender. And, you know, she's an L.A. writer, but, like, her writing totally transcends what you would expect Los Angeles writing to be. And I think she's just, you know, she's just as good as it gets. You know, she's just absolutely wonderful. And, you know, the fact that her last book, because, you know, she's been publishing books pretty much since she graduated from the workshop back in 97, I think, because I think her first book came out in 98 or 99, and the fact that, like, her latest book last year, Particular Sadness of Lemon Cake, hit the New York Times bestseller list and got great reviews, it's like, it's enormously gratifying to see somebody who has such a particular vision of what their writing is, because I think she would call herself an L.A. writer, too, to see someone achieve success, you know, in a mainstream way, but also who's someone who's just been kind of like writing her own version of Los Angeles. And I think that that's the thing that often gets missed is that, you know, there is no one sort of idea of what L.A. literature looks like. There is no sort of one fictional representation that says, oh, give me the one book about L.A.
I think it's probably impossible.
Yeah, you would need a whole stack of books. So
right.
I think that's probably where a lot of that confusion, you know, comes from. The fact that, like, you can't say, what is the quintessential L.A. novel? What's the quintessential L.A. story? Because there's so many of them. And I think that that just speaks to, you know, the richness and diversity of the city. And, you know, I think that probably the greatest compliments that I've gotten about Madonna's is from people, you know, when I was doing the book tour, people who lived in Encino, people who lived, you know, nowhere near Echo Park, saying, this is Los Angeles.
Right.
And,
well,
that's really gratifying.
Right. I think that's great. Well, there's one more question I want to ask you about.
Oh, please do, yes.
You know, I must say I felt kind of odd that in all of them, there's so much marketing about the book that portrays you as they have on the Simon & Schuster website, and I hope they don't get mad at me for saying.
Oh, they're very understanding people. I love everyone there, so they'll be fine. Go, fire away.
All right, a new voice in ethnic literature, and then all the comparisons. It's Juno Diaz, Chang Rae Lee, you know, Sherman Alexie. I feel sort of like...
All great writers, I might add. All phenomenal writers.
Right, all great writers, but does it bother you, or do you feel somehow that it's awkward to be identified as an ethnic writer as opposed to just being identified as a writer?
That's a really important question, and I think it's something that, you know, it depends on your perspective, shall we say. You know, if you had asked me that question if I would publish maybe 10 years ago, yeah, I probably would give you a very different response. But having worked inside publishing, like, I know where that instinct comes from. And that's not to say, like, yeah, you know, like, if, let's say, you know, Franzen or you know, take your pick of, like, you know, a sort of, like, major mainstream writer. It's like, you know, people don't say Franzen is the finest white male suburban writer today. You know, there's not that sort of long stream of qualifiers. You know, when I like the fact that, like, if my writing, you know, wouldn't have to have those long string of qualifiers with it? Maybe not. It doesn't bother me because I understand that the publishing mechanism, the people who make these decisions, are trying to find a way to categorize my work and communicate where my work goes on the bookshelf in the quickest way possible to the reader. Now, whether that method of categorization actually helps sell books anymore, well, we could have an entire, we could have another hour discussion about that. I think that the model of publishing is dependent or has been dependent on, putting people into those sort of categories and putting people into those boxes in the most efficient way possible, because that's how books have been sold for so long, and that's how books have been sold efficiently for a certain period of time. Now, as the sort of idea of what, book sales are and, how books are distributed and how books are disseminated, that's changing. And the traditional ideas of how publishing markets a book and puts a book in a particular category, they may be outmoded. They may be antiquated. They may be out of date. I don't really have the answers to those questions. But it doesn't annoy me because I know that the publisher, at the end of the day, wants to sell books, and they want to communicate what they feel the most efficient way to communicate what the message behind my book is or where my book belongs on the shelf.
Well, no, it's a fair point. You're right. No, that's a totally fair point, and I think it's reasonable. In the book business, people think, well, if somebody read Sherman Alexie, they're a candidate potentially to read you. That I understand the link there, but I do think that there's also, because the book is about identity, that it also makes it sometimes too easy to put books in boxes.
I think you're absolutely right, and I think that's an interesting discussion that publishing really needs to have, because if you look at how the model is changing, I just saw the deal, and I can't remember her name. I think her name's Amanda Hawking or something.
Yeah.
She's been self-publishing her books on Kindle, and she just got a $2 million deal from St. Martin's for 4 books, and God bless her. She's 26 years old. She writes a book every month. She makes me look like a total slut. I read her website. She's like, yeah. A good day I get 10,000 words. I'm like, my God, how do you do that? What am I doing with my time? But, that is someone, and that's a story of somebody who completely circumvented the traditional publishing model, found her own audience, went out there, got the platform, got at all the sort of buzzwords that publishers want by creating books that people wanted to read. And it's like, what box do you put her in now? What box? Because, she, on her blog, you see, all of the, stories about how she tried to get published, tried to find an agent, and nobody came calling until she created her own audience. So now what's going to happen to the people who follow her stuff? Are they going to put, what box do you put somebody like this who basically didn't need a box to sell her work? These are questions that I think that publishing really needs to address and ask themselves with. And just to bring it back around to the book that I'm working on now, I'll be very interested to see how the jacket copy and the catalog copy reflects how my memoir is sold. Because, again, I'm writing a memoir about having 5 stepfathers and about, growing up or about being told that I was, Native American when in actuality I'm Mexican American, and about finding my biological father after a 33-year absence. And I've already seen some of the comp titles that they've used, comparative titles, to sort of help booksellers say, oh, okay, so if you like this book, you'll like that book. And none of the comp titles are written by ethnic writers. They're all The Liars Club, The Tender Bar, This Boy's Life, all white writers. But again, all memoirs that have sold in, really large quantities. So again, it's it would make sense for my publisher if you followed the previous model, this guy is writing an ethnic memoir. But, maybe they can't find, an ethnic memoir that has had a really successful sales record.
There is one that they can use, which is Luis Rodriguez.
That's true. That's true. I think that's absolutely true. But, again, publishers tend to go for the, they shoot for the biggest sales record,
oh, yeah.
So they always start at the top of the list. So
and also
I'm more likely to, I'm more likely to see my book compared to, let's say, Glass Castle or any of those other types of books. And again, those are all phenomenal, phenomenal memoirs. So I'd be happy for those comparisons to be made. But I think that this is an interesting time for publishing, because publishing really needs to ask itself, big houses and small, they need to ask themselves, how do we communicate what the book is about, and how do we get that information to readers? Because I don't believe that people enjoy reading any less now because of texting or chit-chatting or any of the other sort of modes of communication we have. I think there's still an audience out there for books.
I think the
way in which they get that information has changed drastically, and I don't think that publishing has quite figured out how to make those two, you know, two places connect.
No, I think that's right. I am, unfortunately, probably a conversation we would have to save for another call, which we could do. You know,
I have getting started, man.
Right, because the issue, I think this is something maybe we can talk about in another conversation, because I do this series of interviews with people in publishing about the future, and you have a unique perspective because you've been editing and working in publishing. Now you're a writer, so you can, you know, today we've got your writer's hat on. I think maybe another call we'll do, another interview we can do, we'll put your publishing hat on.
I'd love it, man. I'd love it.
That would be really fun. Well, listen, I really appreciate talking to you. And I want to say, because I really didn't say it outright, that I loved reading The Madonnas of Echo Park. I only really like to interview writers whose books I liked a lot.
Thank you. I wouldn't be talking
to you if I didn't, but I thought the writing is really great, and I love the interlocking characters. I think that I do admit I love L.A., and I love the whole ethos of L.A. as a patchwork of communities, but which, you know, you've captured an era, and I think a piece of it really well. So,
well, thank you. That's very kind of you. And again, you know, thank you for interviewing me. And hopefully, we can have another conversation like this when the memoir comes out. So,
I think we will.
I very much appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks. This has been David Wilk for Writer's Cast. I've been talking to Brando Skyhorse about his new paperback, The Madonnas of Echo Park. Thanks.